We're Peter and Ricky Thompson. We're from Minneapolis, Minnesota. And we're here teaching ending hunger, E-N-D-I-N-G. A lot of times people say, Indian hunger? What hunger? Because we're not used to putting ending with hunger. We see hunger, most of us, all our lives have seen hunger as something that's inevitable. And what we're talking about today is that hunger is not inevitable, that we can end hunger if we have the will and commitment to do that. Our background is voluntary. Ending hunger is not the career by which either of us earn our living. We have put a book called Ending Hunger into all the schools in Minnesota, and we compiled a curriculum to go along with it. And in the last year, we've in-serviced about 600 teachers so that they can educate the kids in their classrooms about ending hunger and give them some hope for their futures. I'm gonna keep on with that.
Sure.
We feel that ending hunger is an idea whose time has come, that it's something that we can do now if we're ready and willing to do it. What we're doing for the next 2 weeks, we can sum up in three phrases. So if you fall asleep during this session and you get these three phrases, that's terrific. The three phrases are that hunger exists, which we all know, we've seen it on TV, in the newspapers. We're not going to dwell on bloated babies today. The second phrase is that hunger doesn't need to exist. We have the technology, we have the human resources, we have the natural resources to end hunger. And the third premise is that you and I are the key to ending it. I gave the example yesterday. Barbara had talked about Moses in the burning bush. And what follows is a real interesting story, which I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with, of Moses, one of our great religious leaders, asking God to find somebody else to do it. Continually saying, God, I'm not good enough for this job. And God comes back and says, yes, you are. And Moses says, no, I'm not. And God says, yes, you are. And Moses says, ask my brother. And Moses says, I'm not an eloquent speaker. And God says, I want you. I need you to be my instrument to lead the people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. And obviously, we're not God and you're not Moses, but I think you get the idea that it's us that will end hunger.
What the talk is about today, and it's our sessions don't usually turn out to be talks. And in fact, I think our tape ministry contributions will be minimal because about 50% of the talking usually gets done by the people. And that's the way we really like it, because we always learn a lot more by other people's experiences. Our topic, unlike most of the other sessions you go to, is one where everyone has quite a bit of information. We obviously aren't experts in new international economics and agribusiness and demographics and geography and other population issues and things like that. We have some information, we've had some training in those areas, but the information you have can be real valuable. And so we'll give a lot of opportunities for you people to reflect or respond to some of the information that we're going to be going through. What we've done so far is we've had an overview session, and then last night we talked about what is hunger and where the hungry people are, and we did some geography and we went around the planet and looked at some of the infant mortality rates and some of those sort of things. And just maybe a real brief update on that is that the primary indicator used by the experts in the area to determine what is a hungry country or not is the infant mortality rate. And what the infant mortality rate is, and it's often called the IMR, is the number of deaths before 1 year of age per 1,000 live births. And an infant mortality, so in other words, for instance, a very high infant mortality rate would be 100. And what that would mean would be 100 out of 1,000 live births, those babies would die before they're 1 year old. Now that doesn't try and measure kids that would die between 2 and 5 or adults that would die of either starvation or diseases caused by starvation. And so it isn't a direct indicator of hunger, but it has proven to be a very good indicator on a large scale basis. And it's also one of the only factors that countries all over the world keep track of so that we can have some meaningful comparisons and statistics. So for instance, the IMR, infant mortality rate in the United States is 10.5, we learned last night, and the IMR in Afghanistan is 194, which means 20% of the babies that are born there die before their first birthday. So we did that, and we looked around the world, and we got in touch with some of the situations in some of those countries and our interconnectedness with all of those people. And we've put up a map that we got in the bookstore here today called Visions of Peace, and this is the new Peterson map. And you may want to, just as we talk and maybe talk about different countries today, look at that. Does anyone know what the difference in this new Peterson map is and the traditional map that we grew up with in school? Just because it looks funny when you first look at it. What looks different, and who knows what is different about it?
Well, Africa is at the center.
Yeah. Okay.
A portion of the land mass is different too. But
exactly. Those are two excellent points. What this map does, and what the other map didn't do, is it put the center of the globe in the center. The map we grew up with didn't. It put the equator down about here. It skewed it. And the other thing it did is that it had the land masses not accurately reflected. For instance, Sweden looks larger than India on the old map, and Europe is substantially expanded, where actually India is more than 3 times larger than Sweden. And of course that has something to do with who created the map, and it was a German, and he has Germany just about in the middle of the map, both in terms of the horizontal and the vertical axis. And all of us like to think we're a little more important, and it's kind of nice to be in the middle. But this actually shows the accurate, it's not a perfectly accurate map because it's flat and the globe is round. But in terms of the proportionate land areas, this is accurate. So in other words, even though Greenland gets a little skewed because it's up at the top, that's the relative accurate size of Greenland versus, say, Africa. Like Africa and on the traditional map is smaller than the Soviet Union. Well, actually Africa is much larger than the Soviet Union as it appears here. So that's kind of where we are. And today, what we're going to do is we're going to go through some of the myths about hunger, and those are some of the myths that have helped hold it in place and help make us feel like we're more or less powerless to do anything about it. And as Ricky said, what we want to do is end hunger, and so we'll have a very positive approach. And the myths basically are that there's too many people. There's so many people, we can't end it. Secondly, there's not enough food, and so we can't end it. Third, well, why don't we redistribute the food or give more relief aid? Fourth, there really aren't any solutions. Fifth, we can't afford to end hunger. Sixth, we benefit from keeping the hungry people where they are, that is, hungry. And when we get to this one, I'd just like you to think. I was in Mark's class this morning, and he was asking people for some biblical verses, and that the wealth of biblical resource and information amongst the guests here is just staggering. And I'd like a couple people to think about, maybe from a theological standpoint, totally separate from pragmatic considerations or considerations of economics, why it is not beneficial to keep the hungry hungry to us in terms of the Bible. And I think Ricky's probably thought of some too. And seventh, hunger is inevitable, and kind of in conclusion. And that will tie right back into where we are there on the ending hunger. So we'll start out with too many people. That is some of the population considerations. And we have, as usual, we've developed this through an educational system, and it's really a teaching mode. and it's been developed in the schools in the state of Minnesota, so we have some exercises for you to do today. Teaching type exercises, and we need some help reading too. Not because we can't read, but it helps make the points. So basically, before we look at, if there are too many people, anyone have any question now before we start looking at some of these factors? Okay, or responses or ideas? Basically, in determining if there are too many people to feed, we need to look at how many people there are. And if people remember last night, we passed out the population data sheet, and at that time there was 4.9 billion people on the planet, and now that number is up to just a tad over 5 billion people. So that's how many people we had. Now, how did we get there? Basically, population has been increasing on a global scale ever since the beginning of time. And it's been increasing at increasing rates of increase, which is one of the real problems. Back in 1800, the rate of increase was a little less than 1% a year. Presently now, that rate of increase is at those levels in the developing world. It's actually 0.6% per year increase in the developing world. In the less developed world, or the so-called third world countries, there's a much greater rate of increase, and that's one of the real bothersome factors. In fact, it's over 2% annually rate of increase. But globally, what has happened is that in 1900, that rate of increase was still less than 1%. By 1930, it was 1.7%. So not only were the absolute numbers increasing, which you'd expect them to do, but the rate of the increase was also increasing itself. Increased in 1960 to 2.0% per year, which of course, as that rate of increase goes up, the doubling rate for our population goes up geometrically too. In 1975, something real wonderful happened to demographers and those of us who are concerned about the ecology of the planet and things like that. For the first time in history, the rate of increase of population went down, and it went down substantially. It went down to 1.8%. And if you might remember, I think that was a time when the consciousness of people started being aroused about these issues. When the population bomb came out and some of those things, they were saying we're going to have 20 billion people on the planet by the turn of the century back in the late 60s. And by 1975, many countries, primarily countries in the developing world, had slowed their rate of increase. In fact, there are three countries in the world right now that have negative rates of increase. That is, actually, they're decreasing the size of their population, and they're all Western European countries. And then in 1986, that rate of increase went down again. It went down to 1.7%. And so that's very good news. Now, some of the bad news is again, that in the less developed or the third world countries, that rate of increase is higher. In some places, for instance, Kenya, the rate is over 4% per year. So it still poses a real problem. Now, we haven't really got to whether or not that's too many people or not, this 5 billion people we have. And to look at that, we really need to look at food production. Those first two are really the key, what we're going to be talking about today. And hopefully we'll get done with those and be able to handle all the rest. But if we have to spend more time on those first two, that's what's real important, how many people there are and if we have enough food for all those people. I'm going to state a proposition to you now, and then we're going to do some worksheets that the experts have found to be true about population. And that is, now that this rate of increase is going down, they have projected that the population on the planet in the year 2000 is going to be about 6 billion. We have 5 billion now, and in the year 2000 it will be about 6 billion. That's an important figure because I'll just jump ahead a little and tell you that as far as food is concerned, we actually produced enough food back in 1984 to feed 7 billion people. And it's increased every year. so there is an awful lot of food around. In fact, it's more like a plenty rather than a scarcity. And as we look at some of these issues, you'll see that what seems to be a scarcity is democracy and justice and power for the poorest of the poor, as opposed to not enough food. They don't get enough food, but they're also starving for democracy and justice. But, okay, we have 6 billion people. The connection between these developing countries and these non-developing countries, which the experts have determined, is that when, and I know this is a lot of numbers, the infant mortality rate goes down, which means the society is starting to serve the basic needs of their people, not so many babies are dying, is that what happens then is that the population rate begins to go down. It follows it down. So that the traditional thought that first you've got to control population and then hunger will begin to end is actually the reverse. Not that controlling population doesn't have an important part of it, but that when a society starts ministering to the needs of its people, medically, in terms of services, in terms of food, then the response which follows after that is a natural response at reducing population, controlling population. That's pretty revolutionary stuff for most people to hear. And so I think we really need to stop there, get some responses, pass out some of the worksheets, and talk about that and learn about that a little more. Anyone respond to what we've done so far, or particularly that last assertion?
Is there an example of what that happened, or that it's happened, where you had a reduction in birth deaths and then the changes in the population?
There are lots of examples, and that's why in studying particularly some of these developing countries, that is supportable in the studies. I had an interesting thing happen. Just before I left, I was over at Save the Children, where my brother works, and I was picking up a bunch of materials, and I was talking about this, because it's usually controversial. And the director of Save the Children was just walking past, and he said to me, yeah, he said, I've seen that happen. And I said, where? And he said, well, when I was working in West Africa, he said, our housekeeper took the job, and she was with us for some number of months, and she came up to me and she said, you know, now that I have a job and I'm making enough and things are going good, she said, I've decided that I don't need to have any more children. And so usually this phenomenon occurs over several generations, and it's not so explicit, and it isn't like someone flipping a switch like that. But I thought that was a magnificent example where this one person, right in the time of her family planning, was able to so specifically look at that.
So you're saying basically that because they're being fed and educated, they are smart enough to do birth control? I don't quite understand what the cause effect is.
It's not always a direct connection. There's just, this might be hard to, for us to imagine, because we're not in these kinds of circumstances of survival. But if you know that only half of your children are going to survive, you have, you know, double the amount of children. I've heard that said, even a woman, an elderly woman, hearing that from her mother or grandmother here in the United States, that you had to have 4 kids. You had to give birth to 4 if you wanted to. And the children are necessary in order, by 6 or 7, kids are helping out with the work of the family. By 12, they're, you know, like an adult, and they're needed when the parents are sick and when the parents are old. So even though we think, well, it's just an extra mouth to feed, it's very necessary for, you know, parents to have the children.
So you're saying that the population would perhaps stay the same, just that there would be less infant mortality?
Well, people actually, fertility actually goes down as people's needs are taken care of. Not that it's a conscious thing, oh, I'm going to have less kids, but they're just, it's nothing real explicit, but there's just a correlation, just something that statistically happens.
Ricky, isn't it true that many times it is explicit, that children are regarded as forms of social security?
Yeah.
And that if you start to meet people's basic needs, then there are other forms of security. So that it makes having large families, it doesn't make sense to do that anymore. You don't have to do that to survive anymore. So I think for many people, it is really pretty explicit. In order to survive, you have to have large families. If you don't need a large family to survive, you have to have children.
That's yeah. Precisely correct. And we'll really get right to that in these three, and that'll, I passed them off. And that'll make the point. And we'd really like to have people, they're not enough for everyone, in each little packet we sent out each of the three, and they've been selected because it's hunger issues in a developed country, that is the United States, one that's almost got its infant mortality rate below 50, Mexico, which is kind of transitional, and then one from India. And so I think Jack's point will be made, and we'd like to discuss that a little as we go through and just look at these. They're little vignettes about real families from those real countries.
The first vignette is in from a man speaking in Tamil Nadu in southern India. When we were fortunate enough to be able to travel, we down here. We were just wondering if there was someone in the group who has the little story about from Tamil Nadu, from India, who would be interested in coming up here by the mic and reading it out loud. Some of us can follow along and some of us can just listen. We'd like to just come up and read. Great.
The reason we want you by the mic is that it's supposed to go on the tape, and what we've been doing the last 2 days is having a lot of participation, and of course none of it gets on the tape.
Rural family in India. If I did not have my four daughters, I wonder what would have happened to us by now. They are saviors that God has sent to look after us. Soon my eldest daughter, who is 10, will be earning 2 rupees a month cleaning a house for a wealthier family. By next year, my second daughter, who is 8, will be earning money also. If we had sons, we could earn much more since they can do harder labor. But it is nice to have healthy daughters. They look after the young children and make it possible for my wife to work. Soon the younger ones can work too. When Indian parents die, it is a custom to divide up the land they owned among their children. The division of land among our daughters doesn't worry us, however. We don't have any land. The government's family planning workers do not understand our point of view about our daughters. After all the hard work my family does, we can only save 1 rupee per day, about 8 cents, after we have bought our food. This 1 rupee has to be saved for clothing, for illness, and for the needs of the family. When my daughters are able to work, they can add to this savings. And the family planning workers don't understand that I have had 7 children, but only 4 have survived. And I do not know how long these 4 will survive. There is so little help for us when we are sick. If I did not have my children, life would be more difficult for us. What happens when my wife becomes older and cannot work? Who will look after her? The family planning workers are not going to help her then. Our children are important members of this family by age 7. If we do not have elder children, the mother has to stay at home to look after the young ones, and this reduces the family income. By the time they are 12 years old, the children are earning 1/3 of our family's income, which is enough to feed the young ones.
That's really the social security factor Jack was talking about right there, which is so prevalent in the third world. And the aging process is something that's really struck me. I mean, you will meet people that look very aged and very old and incapable of caring for themselves, and they'll be 50 years old. Not only is life expectancy less, but just life is hard.
Do you have any responses to that story?
It keeps talking about the family planning officer not understanding what's going on. What is the family planning officer doing?
I'm not sure.
There have been incredible things in India. I mean, attempts at imposing technology. I mean, first one was to bring over and give them birth control pills and say, you know, you've got to control your births, and they, you know, lot of reports of people eating the pills for food and, you know, things like that. I mean, it's Indira Gandhi was used some castration techniques for a period of time, and it got to a point where there were perks that were given out to officials if, you know, they could convince people to have castrations. And of course, you know, you could get into abuses, and people, you know, would go around and pick up people and drag them in and give them castrations. And when we were there, I talked to some Hindus about the whole thing, and all of the Western family planning techniques just don't work in that culture. And this is kind of a classic example of their resistance to it and their inability to see at all the wisdom of having a smaller family. It just does not make sense to them at this stage in their development.
You had a question back there? Comment?
Yeah, I don't know the name of it. I have it on tape, but there's a United Nations Commission that year after year does a study about population and makes recommendations, and year after year their recommendation for so-called population control is to increase the living standard of the people. And the illustrations and the discussion about medical care, each of those is just another facet of living standard. And as you talk about the third world and European countries, again, the comparison of living standard illustrates that those countries which have a good living standard or those populations have a less a birth rate. And of course, that study is one that the people from this country just put aside and don't take the recommendations. And so the attempts at improving living standard is not what's done, but attempts at some kind of birth control mechanism, which, as you said, really the people don't buy it because it doesn't touch what their needs are.
There's a real interesting little anecdote about a group, what's the name of the group, that went down to Colombia. And their goal was to help poor people, poor villagers, you know, raise their standard of living. But they wanted the villagers to do it themselves, to not impose, you know, Western technology. So the people in the village got together, and what they wanted to do first before anything was to spend the money to put a statue of the Madonna on the local hillside. Well, you can imagine the American workers' dismay, to say the least, at this idea. And you know, we're always certain that we know what's best, but that wasn't their philosophy. So they let the people of all things build the Madonna on the hillside. Well, in order to do this, they had to terrace the entire hillside and build roads up to the Madonna. And lo and behold, they got the Madonna up there, and there was a tremendous sense of community pride, for one thing. And also, the entire hill was terraced, so they could plant it. So, you know, bit by bit, in fact, somehow, the people knew what it was they needed, and they did it, and it worked. So that just kind of, you know, corroborates what you're saying.
In India, there's also a sense of north versus south, and a lot of people in the south have a feeling that the north and the government are trying to impose some of their ways and keep down the population in the south so that they don't build up. And that's, we were there 8 years ago, and that was the situation then. Of course, just coming out of the Gandhi panic, to a certain extent. But there is a division north to south. There's a division among the people. They may share a faith, but they ethnically, racially, whatever you want to do, there's quite a difference, and they feel that separation very strongly. So there's some real strong resistance to the government federally funded plans for family planning.
The next little story is told by a woman in Mexico, and we'd like another volunteer who likes to read out loud.
Anyone else have the Mexico story?
Or if you don't, you can borrow it. Great.
I don't have it, but I'll...
Come on up.
Okay. Marta Luisa is a 40-year-old mother of 7 children who lives in a small village in Mexico. The village has undergone great change since Marta and her husband were married. When they were first married, farming was done by hand on their own small farms. Now most of the farms are large and use machines and irrigation. Small farms were bought by richer farmers, and small farmers had to become laborers on the large farms to earn a living. Marta's family has only a house and a small garden. Maria's husband works on the big farm, but there isn't enough work there for her children, and even her husband only works part of the year. If I could go back and choose the number of my children, I would only have 1 or 2. Look at me, I look so old. That is because we work so hard with all these children, and there isn't enough food for all of us. I don't need more children. We would need more land if we had more mouths to feed. Once it was, but it is not important anymore, to have children help with the work in the fields and in the house. Now the more children you have, the more work you have. I'm going to teach my daughters about family planning. I'm going to tell them so that they will have a choice of how many children to have. 3 children is the most they should have. Even 4 is all right, but no more than 4 for sure. Times have changed. We can't have 10 children anymore. There's no work for them. But the men say terrible things about women who want birth control. Some say the only reason you want it is so that you can go with other men.
In response to that, that's now from Mexico, which is, you know, a quantum leap up in terms of the society in general and the conditions of poverty, although it's still a hungry country and it's still in the developing world as opposed to the so-called developed world.
Part of the problem in Mexico now that the wealthy landowners have bought up the property and then they raise crops. Are those crops sold like to the United States or whatever? And then is there no land left for the poor peasants?
That's correct.
Yes. So that their problem is compounded by technology, even within their own country.
It's a big part of tomorrow's lesson. You just did it.
No,
no, that's wonderful. That's exactly what happens, because that's exactly what happens.
Yeah. Often they don't even buy the land. They just push people off of it.
Yeah. So you can get strawberries all year round now, and it's not raised at home. And that's why they're still low priced, because the people that they're paying to raise them in Mexico don't make anything, and they've lost their own land.
A question, I don't know, is Jack there, Jim? It was. He had to go. If they have land reform and redistributed to small farms, does that encourage people who have larger families again to work the farm?
No.
Would not according to their first premise, that if you raise the standard of living among the people, that then the need to have large families is lessened.
I just noticed that in the little reading, it was talking about how many needed to work on the land, but they don't own the land.
They have not cooperatives in Mexico. I thought I read somewhere that there were some places where they, to use the technology, they would pool individual farms and have kind of a collective where they work cooperatively, and then they could use the technology. They didn't need the large families to work it inefficiently. Or was that somewhere else?
Well, that was on the PCR about the Grameen Bank. That's happening in India, women forming specially collectives to do work together. I don't know about Mexico. Maybe somebody else does.
Well, in Mexico, they do have this, what they call the tejido structure, where they have cooperatives, but those were started basically by a President Cárdenas in the 30s. And since then, I mean, they haven't really restructured the system anymore. And so a lot of those people have had kids. They don't have any more room. Even though it's cooperative, it's still family owned with other families. And you can pass those down through the generations, but with too many children, you know, with that structure, they could change it so it wouldn't be so, but with the old structure that they used to have. But I was just going to comment to the question that Mark had. Because if you would have land, and I know this has happened in Central America where we lived for a couple of years, that once people got land, they felt less need to have kids, because when before they had land, they had to, you know, hire their kids out on other people's property, and the wages were really small. And so in order to get more wages, they would try to have more kids to work more, to get paid more. Whereas once they got their own land, they could grow their own food, and they would need less, it wouldn't need as many people to work. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so much the land needed the work, it was that the family needed the money, and that's why they did it.
And it's separate, what you're kind of taking, like you'd be the situation in India where they start to have more kids, and the situation in Mexico, getting back to the gentleman's point back there about the UNICEF reports, is generally better. So they are not so concerned about the kids dying. And so they wouldn't necessarily have to have so many kids to work the land, because they wouldn't have in the back of their mind, you know, I'm going to lose 2/3 of them or half of them.
But I think it's more complex than just who has the land. That Sarah said if they can raise food on the land, well, that's when they can raise food on the land. The first world countries have the third world countries so badly in hock that third world countries are forcing the people to raise cash crops, which means they're raising tobacco and strawberries, bananas, and beef for consumption in the first world, but not for consumption at home, and then they don't have food. So it's more than just, well, who has the land? It's very complex.
That's precisely true. Who has the land is a necessary starter to get some of the power to those people, but there are a lot of discriminatory things. We'll talk about most of those tomorrow. Tariffs that the United States sets up on products, the transportation of the products, the sort of pesticides that are used down there, all sorts of things. Markets that would be available for those people to sell their products, credit that they could get to get started, you know, all of which aren't in favor of poor people. But, so you're right, but they've got to have the land to start to have the ability to have the power to produce the crops.
And usually the cash crops that are being exported to us are the ones that are being grown on the big plantations that are owned by the Americans. I think when the people have their little piece of land back, it's probably not to grow export crops. You know what I'm saying? Like Del Monte comes in and, yeah, you know, kicks people out, and those are the export crops.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I've also heard a lot of reports where the seeds and necessary fertilizers simply are not available locally for growing food, so that, you know, the tariffs and the local government restrictions in many cases do preclude families from surviving. Mm-hmm. They just don't have the wherewithal to grow food. You can't grow it if you don't have seeds, and when it's simply unavailable, they're in bad shape.
Sure.
So the standard of living is still in the picture, but the standard of living is for the strawberry eaters and not for the growers.
Great. We should try and finish. I mean, even if we just get through too many people, that's going to be fine for today. Because once we handle those first two, the rest of them fall right out. We can do those in a few minutes, as opposed to dangle on them. But this is an excellent lesson to learn.
Oh my gosh, it's quarter to
five. Let's do the third one on the U.S. Just so you get the whole sweep of the situation. Do we have a Helen? Would you read? Oh, you're leaving to serve. Okay. But could we have a reader on the U.S.? Great. Again, just what you hear here is people's attitude toward the size of their families, the real important part, how people make the decision.
I think two kids are enough for one family to have. Good grief, I can hardly keep the two we have in clothing. Bills just seem to get worse every year. I shudder to think about how we're going to send them to college. Scholarship funds are getting cut every year. I wish Jim and Mary weren't so close in age. They will be starting college about 2 years apart if they go at all. But right now, just buying clothes is a problem. The kids are growing fast, and I can hardly keep up. Not only that, they want everything they see advertised or the latest fad at school. When I'm at work, I worry about the kids. Daycare was expensive. Now they're both in public school. And now I worry about them during the time between when school gets out and I get home from work. With kids, your social life is shot. I remember after the first baby, it got more difficult to get together with friends. Dan and I haven't had more than one or two evenings alone in a year. Already we're thinking about retirement. We've both got pension plans at work, and if everything goes well, we'll do all right when we retire. The kids will probably take off and move away. Boy, I've sounded negative. Actually, I really love the kids. It's just with any more of them, our finances would really be pushed to the limit, and I would be worn to a frazzle. The kids would really get the short end of the stick then. That's why we decided to only have two.
So everyone gets the overall picture about population control. That's not to say that population control isn't crucial. I mean, China did probably the most remarkable thing to end hunger imaginable with a quarter of the people in the world. They have a billion people now, and the way they achieved food sufficiency was through two means. One was through the program you've all heard about, one kid. It's a totalitarian regime, and they say one kid, and that's it. And they had an infant mortality rate of 160 two decades ago. Terrible. And now it's down to 49. And the other thing was they instituted...
Same contrast. It's in the Philippines.
That's a nursery in the Philippines in one of the hospitals. I thought I had trouble finding Michael in the nursery. And the other thing that the Chinese did very well was a program called Barefoot Doctors, and they basically trained, they aren't really doctors, but like paramedics, and to go right out all throughout the country and to be able to bring just some basic hygiene and basic medical care to a billion people. And it's increased their standards of living dramatically. The other thing is how much food. Well, just to give you an idea, in 1984, the world produced 4,000 million metric tons of food. That's a lot of food. It's enough food for 7 billion people already, as I said, and we produce more every year. The sustainability of the food and the environment and how we go about it is real important, and we'll talk about that just a little today and more on days to come. But just the grain alone that the world produces would be enough if it were distributed equally to give each person on the planet two loaves of bread every day, which would be enough calories for everyone right there. That's before you talk about meat and fish and vegetables and fruits and all the other things. So really there's an abundance. And some of the things people have brought up here really show where the scarcity is. It's a scarcity of fairness and democracy, rather than a scarcity of food itself. So food production has increased faster than population growth. One of the reasons we all had the idea that there's not enough food and there's too many people and hunger was inevitable is that's what Thomas Malthus said. He said, population is growing faster than food production. He said, therefore, hunger is inevitable. And since that time, that's always been entrenched. And people just haven't said the opposite to liberate us from those constraints. And so it's no longer true. And the technological advances obviously have been remarkable. Now in terms of food production, there are a lot of issues that we could talk about here about the Green Revolution and about some of those things. But I wonder if we shouldn't kind of just go through the other myths instead, because well, we've got 12 minutes left. Should we just keep going? Okay. One of the things people say, well, if there's enough food, and in fact, there are not too many people for that amount of food, why not redistribute it? Why not, honey?
Because in India alone, there are 700,000 villages, which is, I couldn't understand what that meant until we took the train across southern India, and they're just these little dots of villages all over the place. And some of these villages are very remote, and you've probably, you know, seen on TV and stuff, people trying to get relief food, relief grain to people in remote villages that never arrived. So that's probably something you already know, is that redistribution doesn't work very well, although redistribution and relief is certainly necessary. We're not saying don't do it. Of course, it's necessary to save lives, but on a long-term basis, it doesn't really work. And maybe you have some comments or disagreements with that. But.
I heard a Peace Corps worker from Senegal talk about a problem with distributing the food in Senegal because the period of colonialism, all the highways were built radially. Everything comes into Dakar. And so if you're in a little village up here in the Northwest, the only way you can get to the, you know, another part of the country is to come this way and go back out. And so the whole highway system is built in such a way that it discourages redistribution from one part of the country. And in fact, there was an illustration of one part of Senegal had an abundance of food and people were starving just across the mountain, but because of the highway structure, there was nowhere to get the food.
The French screwed it up pretty good there. They turned their whole agricultural system into raising peanuts.
Peanuts, that's right.
So that, and the people in Senegal didn't need peanuts, but the people in France wanted peanut oil for French cooking. And so not only is there a problem there, but once they get the peanuts, they take it back to France. They do all the processing of the peanuts back in France, which really adds all the substantial value to the product, and so all the money gets made in France also. And then the French had the temerity to turn around and ship peanut oil back to Senegal and sell it to them there. So your whole balance of payments is just, you know, totally out of whack. That's the kind of justice that was left behind with colonialism all over the place.
Well, I would think that another problem with redistribution, of course, I mean, I guess you've already touched on it, but it has a lot to do with the money. In the United States, we can afford to pay the transportation fee to ship the food from Mexico and wherever. And in some of the third world countries, there is no money or at least a transportation system to get it sent around.
It also
we have to start lower than that to solve the problem.
Mark?
I don't fully understand here. I mean, even in the medieval period, one of the things that there's efficiency involved. Some land is better producing one thing than another. I'm not talking about exclusive cash crops, but that some areas will produce much more grain in the same acreage, and others will produce much more of something else. And you send it back and forth. Are you suggesting that the solution is that they grow all that they consume locally?
No. We're just saying that. In terms of, you know, supporting a population in Africa, for us to just keep shipping them massive quantities of food doesn't make them self-sufficient in any way. It just makes them kind of dependent in a strange way on
us. You're talking about redistribution, you're talking about from, say, the United States to Africa.
Yeah, massive food shipments.
That's a good point from the United States to Africa, though. Another problem is, and a lot of the problem is, as you stated, in other words, the people should be able to be self-sufficient and raise most of what they need there. Once they become self-sufficient, they can expand, have, you know, more efficient agribusinesses, and they could begin to export things like that. One thing that, so, you know, you can have both of the factors that you're talking about. One thing that's happened in Africa with relief is that we've sent all the wheat over to Africa from time to time. It does two things. Number one, it ruins the economy there because with all the wheat coming in, the farmers then quit planting because it totally knocks the pins out of the market there. And so you come around to the next year and there isn't any local grain coming up. The other thing you do is they don't plant wheat over there. And when you start sending wheat in and changing people's tastes, then, you know, the indigenous products and staples that they have there may be shifting and there may not be the market for the farmer at any rate. And so we can screw up all sorts of the internal dynamics and economies of distant countries by shipping massive amounts of food there.
Even diet, in terms of dietary acceptance, I've heard stories of where powdered milk was shipped, and number one, milk was seen as a food for babies. The people had a lactose intolerance, so it actually was not nutritionally sound for, it was, I don't know what country, Africa. And the people ended up using it to mix up face paints, you know, for paint. They didn't want to eat it, so.
They don't have a clean water supply either to make the milk.
Sure.
That's really, we should maybe spend a little time here rather than just going forward. Those are real good points. One of the things that someone mentioned last night was the Green Revolution, the development of new seed varieties so that you can get much higher yields. And someone says then, well, that kind of technology certainly is a real positive step, and that's the solution. Well, the statement that the Green Revolution is the solution to all this is also a myth. It is true that the dramatically increased yields can be a real benefit to countries, but there are some downsides to it too. One of it we just mentioned, you know, it may be a different kind of crop than they're really used to. The second thing is that, and this really ties into your question, Mark, is that the development of those seeds really is in the context of a much more advanced agricultural system, a technologically more advanced agricultural system, which relies upon heavier equipment, you know, technology they don't have available, increased fertilizers, increased pesticides, and as a result, there are a lot of negative consequences in the third world. One of them being, back to this land problem, the only people who can really raise crops in that way are the large landowners, not the small people, the small farmers, or the landless people that are the ones who are really hungry. And so if they implement those procedures, that doesn't do much to help the powerless person, the poorest of the poor, in terms of either producing food or being able to earn a decent wage because of the high technology. There is a second problem in terms of like the pesticide use, and Sarah probably saw this and knows much more about it than we could ever talk about, but down in the third world, it's required for these green revolution techniques and these real efficient farm techniques, you need a lot of fertilizer and you need a lot of pesticide. Well, the small grower can't afford either one. And when you bring in the pesticides in large quantities, they don't have the safety technology to use them properly. There are reported cases in Honduras where entire communities of males have become sterile because of the use of pesticides. The application of the pesticides take real elaborate safety procedures. You have to wash yourself afterwards, sometimes three times, and throw away your clothes. Because those pesticides, like with the DDTs, they are bioaccumulative, which means they get into the system, they get into the water system, they work up the food chain, we're at the top of the food chain, and people's body begins to store them. The mother's milk in most Central American countries has 45 times the level, safe level of pesticides that the World Health Organization has established. They can't take off their clothes after they've put the pesticides on the fields because it's the only clothes they have. They're not going to burn their clothes. Where do they wash? And where do they wash their clothes? They don't have sanitary systems. They wash it in the river. What happens to their drinking water? What happens to the groundwater in Honduras? We've taken the pesticides down there and will spray indiscriminately, say over the banana plantations, and the pesticides have a 12 to 15 mile drift in terms of the wind taking it. We talked to someone from the International Sustainable Agriculture Association in Minneapolis, and he said he talked to a priest down there who was driving down the road in his car, and just from the pesticides in the air, he said a yellow mist coated his windshield. And that's going right on the people who are living right next to the banana plantations where they've been forced to live, to work. And the land, of course, could be theirs and traditionally had been theirs. So you get into so many problems of putting these new technological advances into third world countries.